This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled, The Art of Investing, Lessons from History's Greatest Traders. Your lecturer is John M. Longo. Dr. Longo is a professor of professional practice in the Finance and Economics Department at Rutgers Business School. He also has served as a visiting professor of finance at EMBA Global, the joint international executive MBA program of Columbia Business School, London Business School, and the University of Hong Kong. A chartered financial analyst, Professor Longo earned a PhD and an MBA in finance from Rutgers University. He has 20 years of professional investment management experience and has appeared on and has been quoted in various media outlets. Lecture 1. Investing Skill, Strategy, and Temperament.
I once asked Warren Buffett if a great investor is born or made. He said he thought it was a little bit of both. He gave the example of Tiger Woods in his prime. He said Tiger Woods was born with an aptitude for golf, but that Tiger honed his craft by hitting 500 golf balls a day. Buffett and I both believe that investing is part art and part science. So one way to learn about investing is to study the backgrounds and strategies of some of history's greatest investors. That's what this course is all about. In this program, we'll examine the backgrounds and investment strategies of more than 24 of the greatest traders who ever lived. Personal background or history is important because it often plays a key role in the development of an investment philosophy. For example, Warren Buffett's mentor, Benjamin Graham, lived through the panic of 1907 as a young child and later the Great Depression as an adult. These experiences led him to pioneer an investment approach known as value investing, which refers to buying sound investments at bargain prices. And he learned to formulate a strategy called margin of safety, or protection against downside risk. From a macro perspective in the financial markets, play an integral role in the world we live in. The financial markets can help raise money for growing firms. Without financial markets, it would be almost impossible for a firm like Facebook to go from a startup run out of a dorm room to one valued at hundreds of billions of dollars in about a decade. A similar story unfolded for Google, now Alphabet, and at firms like Home Depot, which pioneered the superstore home improvement concept and is one of the largest retailers in the world. Home Depot started with just 2 leased stores. Through the financial markets, which you and I are able to invest in, it managed to raise the money that enabled the company to open more stores and develop the superstore concept. Today, Home Depot operates thousands of stores around the world, resulting in annual sales of about $100 billion. There's no single best way to become a successful investor, just as there's no single best way to sing a song or swing a baseball bat. But there are several principles that many great investors follow. The great traders and investors in this course typically find a strategy that matches their skill set and personality type. They work extremely hard and usually love what they do for a living. Nearly all continue to work well after the point at which they become rich. They don't give up when things go wrong, and they learn from their mistakes. I'm going to tell a lot of stories about some very successful and pretty amazing men and women in this course, but we're going to do more than that. This course serves as a primer on many of the different fields of investing, including stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies, futures, mutual funds, hedge funds, private equity, and distressed assets. And we'll examine the different techniques applied to each of these investments. It's basically a boot camp on investing. So who am I to stand on the shoulders of Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett and all these other great investment professionals to teach this course? Well, that's for you to decide, but I've been teaching investing courses as a professor of finance for more than 15 years, and I've been affiliated with some of the world's great institutions of learning, including Rutgers University, Columbia University, the London Business School, and the University of Hong Kong. I've also worked as a professional money manager for more than 20 years. My first exposure to the stock market was at family gatherings when I was a boy, and where I'd hear my father and relatives talking about some of the popular stocks of the day, like AT&T and IBM. My family invested in the market, even though they didn't work in the financial services industry. By the time I was a teenager, I'd started saving money from various odd jobs, including paper route, shoveling snow, cutting lawns, and working at McDonald's. And like Tiger Woods with his golf clubs, I started investing. I didn't know it back then, but when I bought my first stock, I was following one of the investment maxims of Peter Lynch, the famous portfolio manager at Fidelity Investments. Peter Lynch said, "Invest in what you know." The first stock I bought was Topps, a company that made collectible sports cards. I'd owned baseball cards and football cards as a boy, and I thought it might be a good investment. I didn't know it at the time, but I was also following an investing principle of Benjamin Graham, who viewed stock as the ownership of a business. That is, if you wouldn't want to own the business, you shouldn't buy the stock. I got lucky when my first stock doubled in value, and I was hooked. Academics have a name for this phenomenon. It's called the house money effect. It means that if you're successful in an early experience with a risky endeavor, chances are you'll be more likely to stick with it. The billionaire investor Ray Dalio, who founded Bridgewater Associates, the largest hedge fund on earth, had a similar experience as a teenager. He bought an airline stock that also doubled in value. And he concluded that investing was easy. Of course, he learned it's not easy. And that's what makes investing challenging and exciting. Every day is different. I attended college at Rutgers University, where, as an undergraduate, I double majored in economics and computer science. The economics courses related to my interest in the financial markets. And the courses I took provided a good foundation of how the markets worked, but they didn't cover what successful investors actually do. Between classes, I began reading all the major business publications. And the most popular fund manager featured in them was Peter Lynch of Fidelity Investments. So Lynch became somewhat of a role model for me. Later, I got interested in other great investors too, like Warren Buffett, not only for their investment and business success, but also because of the positive ways in which they lead their lives. I wanted to become an expert in investing, so eventually I pursued a PhD in finance, also at Rutgers. My dissertation combined my academic background in computer science and economics and was related to using artificial intelligence to pick stocks. With an advanced degree in hand, I started out as a quantitative analyst, or quant for short, at Merrill Lynch. A quant is an investor who builds financial models in an attempt to predict the direction of security prices. This approach stands in contrast to the seat-of-the-pants stock picker, or an investor who pores over financial statements and talks to management or other people in the industry. This latter approach is known as fundamental analysis. I was a pretty good quant, but I realized that I would never be a James Simons or a David Shaw, who are two of the pioneers and most successful practitioners of quantitative investment management. And so my strategy evolved to owning high-quality stocks for the long term, an idea I learned mostly from Warren Buffett's example, and I complemented these relatively safe investments with some higher-risk ones. The risky ones involved growth firms with a lot of potential. That's something I learned from the growth investing pioneers Philip Fisher and Thomas Rowe Price, and deep value investments with high potential upside, something I learned from such experts as Benjamin Graham, Seth Klarman, and David Tepper, three of the best value investors ever. Now, when you start investing your own money or have someone manage money for you, you'll have to ask yourself some tough questions. The first is, am I going to be an active investor trying to outperform the market? Or should I buy a handful of low-cost index funds and try to passively make money? There is merit to each approach. It's tough to beat the market. And so buying and holding low-cost index funds that track the market as a whole, or specific sectors like technology or healthcare, makes sense for a lot of people. It makes sense for almost all people, according to John Bogle, the founder of the $3+ trillion Vanguard Group of mutual funds, whose company created the first index mutual fund. But nearly all of the great investors whom we'll meet in this course will tell you there's another way, and that's active management. And it's typically what made them rich and famous. Active investing is predicated on trying to beat the market. Beyond thinking about whether you want to be a buy and hold investor or an active investor, it's important to consider what type of assets you want to concentrate on. In stocks, there are different schools of thought. One approach is value investing, which means trying to buy stocks at a discount to their inherent or intrinsic value. Benjamin Graham developed this field of securities analysis during the first part of the 20th century. And many others, including Warren Buffett, have added their own twist to it. Value stocks tend to sell at a discount to the market because of certain problems or warts. Think of a stock like Apple, which appeared to be on the verge of going out of business before Steve Jobs' return in 1997. Value stocks remind me of one of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes from the 1960s. It was called The Eye of the Beholder, and it featured a woman undergoing plastic surgery on her face. When the doctor and nurses remove the bandages, we see a beautiful woman, the actress Donna Douglas, who bears a resemblance to Marilyn Monroe. You'd think the surgery would be viewed as a success, but the doctor and nurse recoil in horror. The camera closes in to reveal that the doctor and nurse have distorted pig-like faces. In that Twilight Zone episode, a pig-like face was considered beautiful, while the Marilyn Monroe prototype was considered ugly. Beauty is always in the eye of the beholder. Value stocks might look ugly on the surface, but you never know. They might be really beautiful in the long run. Another popular approach to picking stocks is called growth investing. Growth-oriented investors are not so concerned about buying an asset at a discount. Instead, they're looking for leaders in an industry, the next Amazon or Alphabet or Google. This school of thought was developed in the 1950s by Philip Fisher and Thomas Rowe Price. Growth and value are the main distinctions in strategy among stock investors, but there are other approaches too. Before the Great Depression, and before some of the financial regulatory reforms that came out of it during the 1930s and 40s, it was optional for companies to publish audited financial statements. Now, that might be hard to imagine today, but back then, without hard data to rely on, most investors traded on rumors and hot tips. The only information that many investors had came out of a ticker tape machine. The ticker tape machine produced a thin strip of paper with a stock symbol, its price, and perhaps the number of shares traded. That's it. But some investors were really good at reading the tape or figuring out the trend in security prices. Today, this approach can be viewed as an early form of technical analysis. Technical investors look for patterns in price and volume, under the belief that certain trends can be anticipated and repeat themselves. Most investors who adhere to some form of technical analysis believe in a phenomenon known as trend trading or momentum investing. If the trend is up, you'd buy. If the trend is down, you'd sell. Perhaps the greatest trend trader who ever lived was a man named Jesse Livermore, who made and lost several fortunes during the first half of the 20th century. But the story didn't end all that well for Jesse Livermore, and I'll save that one for another day. Another way to differentiate between stocks is by their size, large or small. By size, I mean the amount you'd have to pay if you were going to buy the entire firm, not simply one share. Large companies tend to be more established, have a longer history, and may pay a dividend. A dividend is basically a check the company sends you in the mail. Some companies can generate more money than they can reinvest profitably, so giving a dividend to their shareholders is one way to use this excess cash. And there's a whole class of dividend-seeking investors, including many value investors and others who live off the income. John D. Rockefeller once said, "Do you know the only thing that gives me pleasure? It's to see my dividends coming in." The trouble with buying stock in a large company like Exxon or Walmart is that their size alone means it's unlikely you'll uncover information that the market doesn't already know. In other words, it will be harder to beat the market since everyone, be it Wall Street analysts, professional fund managers, or individual investors, is already watching these firms like a hawk. So some analysts focus instead on small capitalization or small cap companies. Small cap companies are usually defined as firms valued at less than $1 billion. Small companies typically outperform large companies over long periods of time by about 2 or 3% a year. These firms also introduce you to about 50% more risk into your portfolio than their large counterparts. By risk, I'm referring to the volatility of returns in your investment portfolio, a statistical measure known as standard deviation. Risk can be good, and it can be bad. Finding a small cap company that eventually turns into a large cap company is like winning the lottery. But small cap companies are also more volatile, and there may be a dearth of information about them. That said, the general lack of information about a smaller company may be precisely what allows you to uncover an undiscovered gem. Michael Burry, the hero of Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, which was turned into a successful movie, originally earned his reputation by buying small companies. The stock market gets most of our attention, but the bond market is bigger by far. And the bond market doesn't consist only of government and corporate bonds, but also fixed income securities tied to mortgages, student loans, and car loans. Basically, anything that has cash flows can be turned into a bond, including music royalties. The late David Bowie helped pioneer a class of bonds called Bowie bonds, which enabled artists to monetize the cash flows of their music publishing rights. You probably hear the expression, don't put all your eggs in one basket. This is the essence of diversification. Most great investors tend to own a concentrated portfolio of between 10 and 30 stocks. If they're correct in their analysis, and they usually are, they wouldn't be featured in this course, this might be the best way to maximize returns. These investors essentially argue that it's better to have a few eggs in a basket and to watch the basket carefully than it is to own hundreds of eggs in many different baskets. They tend to believe that you can't follow many firms in detail because of limited time and attention. Other great investors follow a much more diversified approach, like Vanguard founder John Bogle, and many of the successful quantitative investors, like James Simons, run dozens, if not hundreds of different investing models. These tend to be managed by quants, who are like the card counters of investing. They make many small bets with the odds in their favor, adding up over time. Still, other great investors, like the macro hedge fund manager George Soros, use leverage or borrowed money as a key part of their investment strategy. Soros became famous in the investing world for betting against the British pound in 1992. His fund earned $1 billion in one day by betting against the Bank of England. Now, in addition to classifying investors as active or passive and being focused on growth or value, stocks or bonds, we can also discern other patterns in investing strategies. For instance, most investors tend to be focused on investments in their home country. Academics call this the home country bias. It's understandable. We're all more familiar with where we live than some faraway place. It's akin to Peter Lynch's maxim about investing in what you know. And often, more information is readily available about our home country than somewhere abroad. But the British-American investor John Templeton, who founded a mutual fund company named after him, believed that one's chances to earn attractive returns increase with broader investment opportunities. As he put it, if you search worldwide, you'll find more and better bargains than by studying only one nation. John Templeton is the one person most responsible for making international investing broadly available to us today. As a result, it's generally as easy to own many foreign stocks and bonds as it is to buy a share of Coca-Cola. We'll come back to that idea later in this course. Now, sometimes you can be your own worst enemy when it comes to investing. A lot of investors chase hot investments and buy things near a peak. Then when these hot investments cool off, you may be disposed to sell near the bottom. That is, you may be inclined to follow the classic misstep of buying high and selling low, the exact opposite of what you want to do. There's a whole school of thought on the tendency of investors to make such mistakes. It's called behavioral finance. Many important thinkers have contributed to this field, including Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman of Princeton University. One investor in particular who made pioneering contributions in this field is David Dreeman. Dreeman is known as a contrarian investor. He's willing to buy what is out of favor, like tobacco stocks when they're being investigated by the government, knowing that the bad times affecting a stock or industry usually don't last forever. Here's why: by limiting your mistakes, you might be able to profit from the mistakes of others. Great investing isn't confined to one strategy, nor is it confined to one gender. In fact, academic studies find that women tend to have better investment performance than men. Women tend to be more patient. They tend to have a greater focus on downside risk. One woman named Hetty Green was an early value investor. Buying cheap and selling dear, she called it. But she also earned the nickname the Witch of Wall Street for her stingy behavior. And despite a fortune that would be worth as much as $4 billion today, Guinness World Records once listed her as the world's greatest miser. I don't think it's a coincidence that many of the great investors featured in this course have signed the Giving Pledge, a program set up by Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, under which the wealthy pledge to give away at least half of their fortunes. Among those to do so and who are featured in this course are Carl Icahn, Bill Ackman, and Ray Dalio. For many wealthy investors, it's just as important to transmit values, the beliefs that generated their wealth, like hard work, persistence, and integrity, as it is to pass on the value of their wealth. Warren Buffett, for instance, once purchased a farm for his son Howard, but charged him market rate rent. Warren believes that just handing someone a big check is not a way to build character or achieve lasting happiness. Buffett's approach brings to mind the old proverb, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. Of course, financial freedom means different things to different people. And it doesn't have to include becoming a billionaire. A more modest goal that nearly everyone aspires to is to have a comfortable retirement. Becoming a more competent and knowledgeable investor will most likely help you in that regard. Becoming a more knowledgeable investor may also provide you with a greater sense of control over your financial future. Many states now require that financial literacy be taught in public schools. And I think that's a good start. But I think that parents should also teach their children about financial matters. I originally learned this myself secondhand. When I was a boy, I was in middle school. My father lost his job during the double dip recession of 1980 and 1981 to 1982. Unemployment rose to the highest levels since just before World War II. At the time, my mother and father had one child in college and three more who hoped to get there. I didn't know much about the financial markets back then, but I didn't like the feeling of what was going on and not being able to make sense of it. Increasing your knowledge about investments is a way to increase your control of financial matters. It means being guided by wisdom, not fear, when bad things happen in the markets and in the economy. Things have come full circle for me as I've taught my own young son about the basics of investing. We bought his first stock, Disney, when he was in the second grade. Of course, my son didn't know anything about Disney's financial fundamentals, but he loved their resort experience. And I knew the company had strong fundamentals and had a great long-term track record. And so, just as when I purchased my own first stock, we were following Peter Lynch's maxim about investing what you know. And we've continued to purchase stocks for my son's college fund in subsequent years, like Apple, because he likes the product. And in this way, I think that Benjamin Graham's concept of viewing stock as ownership in a business can also be communicated to children at a young age. There are other ways to teach your children, grandchildren, or other family members about investing too. You shouldn't feel compelled to follow a single approach, be it from Peter Lynch, Benjamin Graham, or any other investor. During one of my meetings with Warren Buffett, he discussed another thought beyond the one about investors being born or made and about Tiger Woods practicing with his golf clubs. This thought was about the increase in the standard of living around the world, in part because of the role of financial markets in providing capital to innovative firms that needed to grow. Warren said that the average American today lives better than John D. Rockefeller did when he was the richest man in the world at the turn of the last century. We have airplanes, televisions, computers, cell phones, better healthcare, and a host of other advances today that were not available more than 100 years ago. So investing in the financial markets are about more than just the money. It's also about the impact that successful investing and innovative firms can have on our lives